She agreed to be executed in the wolf's place, not knowing. He was the king the old women of Vithara village had a saying they stitched into funeral shrouds and whispered over cradles alike. A life spent in hiding is already half a death. Senamaro had heard it her whole life and believed it only partly, the way you believe in winter when summer is still warm on your skin. She understood the words. She had not yet understood the cost. She was 23 years old, wolfless by birth, and employed by the Ashford Pack's kennels, which is to say she fed, watered, and cleaned up after the animals that her betters considered more valuable than she was. She owned almost nothing. A wool coat with a missing button she'd never replaced. A chipped clay bowl she'd found in a ditch and cleaned. A single copper coin her mother had pressed into her palm the morning she died, telling her it was for luck. Senna kept the coin in her coat pocket, always. She turned it in her fingers when she was frightened. She was, in the night this story begins, very frightened. Chapter 1. The Wolf in the Cage. The Ashford Pack's holding pens sat at the forest's edge, half-rotted timber and iron, smelling of mud and animal terror. Senna arrived before dawn, as was her custom, carrying a bucket of raw meat and a lantern that threw more shadow than light. She was not supposed to be there until sunrise, but sleeping had become difficult lately. The pack's elder council had announced 3 days ago that a rogue wolf, caught trespassing the Ashford boundary in his shifted form, would be publicly executed at the next full moon. That was 4 nights away. She had not seen the prisoner. None of the kennel workers had been permitted close. The guards changed twice daily, spoke to no one, and the pen at the far end, the iron one, built for dangerous animals, had been draped in heavy canvas so that even the shape of what was inside remained a secret. Tonight, one of the guards was absent. Senna noticed the gap in the patrol because she noticed everything. It was the wolfless woman's survival skill, sharper than claws. She stood very still, weighing scents against something she could not name, and then she walked toward the covered pen. She told herself she only wanted to see what manner of creature deserved such silence. The canvas had worked loose on one corner. She lifted it. He was enormous. Even curled on the floor of a cage 2 sizes too small, the wolf read as colossal. Black-furred, thick-shouldered, with a spine that could have served as a ridgepole. But it was his eyes that froze her. They were open. They were watching her. And they were amber, shot through with gold, and fully unmistakably intelligent. Not feral. Not rogue. Thinking. A chain ran from a collar at his throat to an iron ring in the floor, thick as her wrist, short enough that he could not fully raise his head. The fur around the collar was worn raw. She should have walked away. She turned her copper coin over and over in her pocket instead, and crouched down so she was level with those amber eyes. "You understand me?" she said. It was not a question. The wolf blinked. Once. Slow and deliberate. "They're going to kill you in 4 days." She did not soften it. "Is there anything I can do?" He stared at her for a long moment, and then, very slowly, he extended one massive paw toward her through the bars. Senna looked at it. In the center of his paw pad, pressed there deliberately, was a small object he must have been clutching in his shifted form's grip. A thing that had shifted with him, or been passed through the bars by someone. A signet ring, heavy in gold, bearing a crest she had never seen in her life. She picked it up. He pulled his paw back. He watched her face. She turned the ring over. The crest was a wolf's head crowned, circled by the words she had to tilt toward her lantern to read. "Vorith Pack, Blood of the Northern Throne." The word throne sat in her mind like a stone dropped in still water. "You're not rogue," she whispered. "Are you?" One slow blink. She closed her fist around the ring and stood up. Her legs felt unsteady. Her brain was running ahead of her conscience. And her conscience was losing ground fast. Chapter 2. The Ledger of Small Debts. She did not sleep at all. She sat on her cot in the kennel workers' shared dormitory and thought about every story she'd ever heard about the Elder Council of the Ashford Pack. Elder Draven, who had cheated her mother out of 3 months' wages over a claimed breakage that never happened. Elder Tossa, who had signed the decree that wolfless children could not attend the pack school. The whole edifice of their authority, built on the assumption that power decides what is true. They had called him rogue. They had chained him and covered his cage and scheduled his death, and none of the kennel workers had been allowed to ask why. She turned the signet ring over and over. It was warm, as if it held a memory of being worn. By morning, she had made a decision that was, objectively, idiotic. She recognized this. She made it anyway. She was going to speak to Elder Draven. Not on the wolf's behalf. That would get her dismissed before she opened her mouth. She was going to present herself as a witness. She had seen something in the holding pens, she would say. An irregularity. She needed clarification on the execution protocols. It was, she reasoned, the kind of small maneuvering that wolfless women had always done. You could not push against power directly. You knocked on doors and asked questions and listened to what was not said. Elder Draven received her in his office with the particular distaste he reserved for the lower kennel staff. He was a heavyset man who wore his silver rank chain like a second spine, always straight, always visible. He had small eyes and a large voice, and he spoke before she could finish her first sentence. The creature is sentenced. The council has ruled. Your function in this matter is to continue feeding the other animals, not to engage with the prisoner. He paused. Did you approach the pen? She met his gaze. I noticed the canvas was loose. I was concerned about a security breach. Then you should have reported it to the guards. He looked at her the way he looked at all wolfless people, through her, toward the door. That will be all. She left. She stood in the corridor outside and pressed the ring against her sternum through the fabric of her coat. The thing she had not said, and that he had not given her room to say, I know who he is. And if I know, someone else will know. And the political consequences for this pack when a northern king is executed on false grounds will be... She stopped. King. She had read the word on the ring and not let herself follow it to its conclusion, because the conclusion was too large. She stood in the corridor with her hand flat against her chest, and she followed it now. Vorith Pack, blood of the northern throne. Not a noble, not a lord, a king. Possibly the king. The sovereign of the Northern Alliance, whose goodwill the Ashford Pack depended on for their lumber trade, their grazing rights, their protection from the western borders. The elders either didn't know, which was carelessness, or they knew and intended to claim ignorance afterward, which was murder with a strategy attached. She had 4 days. Chapter 3. The Shape of a Trade. She went back to the cage that night, and the night after. She brought extra water, slipping past the gap in the patrol with the precision of someone who had spent a lifetime being overlooked. She spoke to him quietly while he drank, telling him what she'd learned and not learned, watching his eyes for confirmation. On the second night, she told him about the ring. I've kept it safe, she said. I didn't show it to anyone. I don't think showing it to anyone here would help you. They'd just say I found it somewhere, or that you'd stolen it, or... He made a sound low in his chest. Not a growl. More like an acknowledgement. There's a courier rider who passes through Vithara on the northern trade road every 5th day, she said. The next one is in 2 days. If I could get a message through, but I don't know who to address it to. I don't know your name. He watched her. Then he shifted, just his right forepaw, bones crackling in the dark, and with one partially shifted finger, he pressed into the dirt of the cage floor a single letter, and then another, and then a third. K-A-L. Cal, she said. He settled back. His eyes closed briefly, as if the partial shift had cost him. Cal. She turned the name over. An ordinary name. Not a king's name. A man's name. I'll get a message out. I'll try. She paused. But the courier won't reach the north in time for a reply. She could see him process this. The amber eyes came back to her, and there was something in them she would later describe only as recognition. As if he were seeing, clearly and for the first time, the full shape of their situation. "I'm going to speak to the council again," she said. "I'm going to offer them a deal." He made a sharp sound. She looked at him. "I know," she said. "It's a terrible idea." She pressed the ring safely into the bottom of her coat pocket, beside the copper coin. Two objects now, carried like prayers. Chapter 4. The Offer. She asked for a formal hearing. She was told no. She asked again and was told no again, this time with a guard at her door. The third morning she walked into Elder Draven's session without invitation, which was a trespass that cost her the kennel position on the spot. She was dismissed before she reached the center of the room. "Wait," she said, and her voice came out steadier than she felt. She pulled the signet ring from her pocket and set it on the council table. The silence in the room changed quality entirely. Elder Tossa, who had been looking at her the way you look at something you're about to step on, looked at the ring. Then he looked at Draven. Something passed between them. Not surprise, she noted. Something more careful than surprise. They knew who was in that cage. The cold that moved through her was thorough and complete. She kept her face very still. "Where did you get this?" Elder Draven said. "That doesn't matter." She kept her hands loose at her sides. She was wolfless and unemployed, and standing in a room with four elder wolves who could have her removed, imprisoned, or worse, and she was choosing to speak. A life spent in hiding is already half a death. "What matters is that I know who you have in that pen, and I know that when the Northern Alliance discovers one of their line was executed by Ashford, this pact's trade agreements will dissolve so fast you'll all be penned yourselves before winter." The silence stretched. "I also know," she continued, because she had planned this part carefully, "that an execution still satisfies whatever territorial precedent you're invoking. The crime was trespass. The sentence is death." She breathed. "You don't need him dead. You need someone dead. I'll take his place." Elder Tosi stared at her. "You're offering yourself as a substitute execution. I'm offering you a way out of a catastrophic political mistake." She met his eyes, which was something wolfless women were not supposed to do with elders, and held them. "Accept the substitution. Release him before the full moon. No one outside this room needs to know the details. And in exchange, you don't have a Northern war on your hands." The four of them looked at her the way powerful people look at unexpected problems, with a mixture of calculation and contempt. "She's serious," one of the lesser elders said. "She's wolfless," Draven replied, as if that answered the question. "Which makes the substitution legally cleaner," Tosi said slowly. He was the strategist, she had always sensed, the one who played long. "A wolfless woman of no pack standing. The sentence is technically satisfied. We release the creature on grounds of misidentification." He looked at her with something like reluctant respect. "You understand what you're agreeing to?" "Yes," she said. She did, and she didn't. She knew she was agreeing to death. She had spent two sleepless nights trying to find another answer and failing, and she had arrived at this one not from despair, but from a furious, final decision that she was done letting powerful men decide who was expendable. If someone had to be, she would choose herself, on her own terms, for her own reasons. She would not hide. "We accept," Tosa said. She walked out of the room. Outside, she sat on a stone wall in the pale morning and turned her copper coin over in her fingers until her hands stopped shaking. Chapter 5. The night before. They gave her a room, an improvement over the dormitory, which felt like a dark joke. She was a condemned woman who now had her own window. She used the night to write two letters. One to the courier on the northern road, addressed simply to the Vorith seat, urgent regarding the safety of the king, and one to nobody, which she burned in the hearth because some things are only for saying and not for sending. She visited the cage one last time. He knew something had changed. She could see it in the set of his shoulders when she approached. Not relief, exactly. Something more conflicted. "They've agreed to substitute," she said. "You'll be released tomorrow before dawn. The courier has the message and my letter. It names the Ashford Pack's actions, gives the dates, all of it. The ring is in the letter." She laid her hand flat on the bar. "So you'll have your proof, and your people will have warning." He had risen to his feet. He was facing her fully, and in the lantern light, the gold in his eyes was very bright. She realized she was crying, which she hadn't intended. "Don't," she said, to herself as much as him. "I decided this. It's a good decision." She pressed her palm more firmly against the iron. I wanted someone to know that I chose this. Not because I thought my life was worth less than yours. Not because I was expendable. Because you weren't guilty. And someone had to say so. And I was the one standing there." His enormous head lowered until his brow was resting against her hand through the bars. She stood there for a long time. The forest beyond the pens was very quiet. An owl called once and went silent. "If you ever have the chance," she said finally, "to do something for someone who has nothing to offer you in return, do it. That's all I want." She took the copper coin from her pocket and set it on the ledge of the cage, in the space where the canvas lifted. "For luck," she said, "wherever you end up." She walked back to her room and sat in the window until morning. Chapter 6. What dawn brought instead. They came for her at first light. Two guards, formal, not unkind, which surprised her. She was brought to the central clearing where the execution platform stood, and she stood on it with her arms at her sides and her chin level and thought about her mother's hands, and about amber eyes in the dark, and about a saying stitched into shrouds. She was not hiding. She was, for perhaps the first time, entirely visible. Elder Tossie stepped forward to perform the sentencing rite. He raised his hand. And then, from the tree line, something happened that later she would struggle to describe as anything other than a weather event, as if the forest itself changed its mind about what it was doing. 40 wolves broke the tree line. Not in a chaotic rush, in formation, disciplined, silent, and enormous. At their center, larger than all of them, unmistakably in command, ran a black wolf with amber eyes and a stride that swallowed ground. He shifted on the run. By the time he reached the edge of the clearing, he was a man, tall, dark-haired, wearing nothing but authority and several impressive bruises, and he was moving with the focused intent of someone who has been waiting to arrive for 4 days and is running out of patience. "Stop," he said. His voice was not loud. It didn't need to be. The 40 wolves behind him had stopped at the clearing's edge. The Ashford guards had frozen. Elder Tosa had lowered his hand, and Elder Draven had gone the color of old ash. Senna stood on the platform and stared. The man, Cal, crossed the clearing without slowing, and stepped up onto the platform and stood in front of her and looked at her with those amber eyes from a distance of about 2 feet, which was so much more overwhelming than 2 feet should have been. He had retrieved clothing from somewhere. He was wearing a traveling coat with a crown crest pin at the collar, which she recognized because it matched the signet ring she'd tucked into that courier letter, which was apparently not necessary because he was here, in person, having arrived approximately one sunrise too early for her to have been executed. "Senna Morrow," he said. She blinked. She had not told him her name. "The courier you sent," he said, reading her expression. "She caught up with my advance riders. They'd been looking for me since I missed my check-in 4 days ago." His jaw tightened. "We rode through the night." "Oh," she said, which was not, she felt, adequate to the situation. "They told me what you agreed to," he said. "The substitution." Yes. "You offered your life." His voice was controlled, but underneath it she could hear something raw and uncontrolled trying to surface. "For someone you didn't know." "I knew you were innocent," she said. and I knew they were going to get away with it unless someone made it complicated for them. I was the only one in a position to complicate it. She looked at him steadily. It was a practical decision. It was not a practical decision. He took one breath. It was the bravest thing I've ever witnessed, and I have been at war twice. She did not know what to do with that, so she said nothing. He turned to face the Elder Council, and the temperature in the clearing dropped. What followed was not, technically, a confrontation. It was more like a geological event. The Northern King addressing a Minor Pax Elder Council in a clearing at dawn about the small matter of his own attempted execution was a thing that rearranged the political landscape, the way a river rearranges a valley, completely, and with no concern for what had been there before. Elder Tossa began a defense and stopped halfway through a sentence when the 40 wolves at the treeline shifted their weight in unison. Elder Draven said nothing at all. There were terms. Senna did not hear all of them. She was standing on the platform still, feeling very separate from the proceedings, thinking about how peculiar the morning light looked, pale gold through the trees, which had not cared about any of this. Then a hand closed around hers, large and warm, and she looked down at it, and then up. Cal had not moved away from her while he spoke. He had not released her hand since he took it. She wasn't sure exactly when he'd taken it. Chapter 7. What He Asked. In the aftermath, elders chastened, rights negotiated, guards dismissed, she found herself in a small room in the Ashford Lodge with a mug of hot tea she hadn't made, and a fire she hadn't lit, and a large, dark-haired man sitting across from her with an expression she couldn't entirely decode. He had recovered the signet ring. He was turning it in his fingers. She recognized the motion.
"You do that, too,"
she said, before she thought about whether she should. He looked up.
"What?"
"Turn something in your fingers when you're thinking. I do it with—" She stopped. Her copper coin was back in her pocket. She'd gone and found it on the cage ledge in the chaos of the morning, retrieved it while everyone was looking at the king. "Something I keep in my pocket." "What happened," he said, "when your mother died?" She blinked. "How do you know about—" "The letter you sent told me your name. My riders knew Vithara, a wolfless woman, kennel worker, named Senna Morrow." He paused. "I wanted to know who you were." She looked at her tea. "She died 4 years ago. She was a laundress. The pack paid her less than they paid the wolfed workers, and she knew it and couldn't do anything about it." The bitterness of it was old now, more texture than pain. "She gave me a copper coin the morning she died, and told me it was for luck." He was quiet for a moment.
"What would you do," he said carefully, "if you could do anything? If position and pack affiliation and resource were not the limiting factors?"
She looked at him. "That's not a real question." "I'm the Northern King. I can make it a real question." She thought about it seriously, because he was asking seriously, and she owed him that. "The Vithara Pack School," she said. "Wolfless children are excluded." "I'd change that. And the wage disparity, there's no justification for it. It's just tradition layered over contempt, and it needs a formal ruling that makes disparate pay illegal." She stopped herself. "That's not what you were asking, probably." "That's exactly what I was asking." Something shifted in his expression. Not surprise. More like a piece of a pattern completing itself. "I've been trying to get a legal counsel appointment filled at the Northern Court for 2 months. The position advises on right standards for wolfless and unmated omegas in pack territories. Every candidate I've reviewed has been," he paused, "theoretical, academic, no grounding." She stared at him. "You'd need to come to the Northern Court," he said. "Vithara is a long way south." "You're offering me a job." "I'm offering you a place," he said. "That is not the same thing." He set the signet ring on the table between them. "I am also, and you're entitled to refuse this entirely. It carries no conditions. Telling you that in 4 days of sitting in a cage, thinking I was going to die, you were the only thing that made the darkness bearable. And that frightens me considerably more than the cage did." The fire crackled.
Outside, she could hear his wolves moving, the low rumble of a large group settling into camp. She looked at the ring on the table. She thought about amber eyes in the dark, pressing a paw through iron bars with a signet ring balanced in the curl of enormous fingers. She thought about the saying on shrouds and cradles, "A life spent in hiding is already half a death." She reached into her pocket and set the copper coin on the table beside the ring. "I'll come north," she said, "but I'm keeping my coin." The look that crossed his face then was not a kingly expression at all. It was just a man, relieved beyond what he knew how to say, smiling like he'd been given something he hadn't known he was allowed to want. "Keep it," he said. "I'd like to hear more about your mother." So she told him, and he listened, which was the thing nobody had ever done before, and it felt like standing in a window with the sun coming through. Chapter 8. The Road North. They left Vithara on a bright cold morning, the northern party and one wolfless woman in a borrowed traveling coat that fit better than her own. She walked beside Cal's horse until he reached down and lifted her up without asking, which she would normally have objected to, except that she had been on her feet since before dawn, and her pride had taken enough of a beating lately. She rode in front of him on the saddle, which was a more practical arrangement than it was a romantic one, though the line between those two things became somewhat blurred on long roads, with shoulders to lean against. He told her about the Vorith court, sprawling, cold, architecturally overwhelming, full of people who would try to evaluate her and find her wanting by every metric they had designed to ensure she would be found wanting. He told her this plainly, without apology, as a map of the terrain rather than a warning to retreat. She told him about the 12 ways a wolfless woman learns to make herself invisible in a room, and how she planned to use exactly none of them anymore. "Good," he said. "It's harder than it sounds." "I know." His arm tightened slightly around her. "I'll be there." She thought about that. She was not accustomed to people being there. She had spent 4 years being very competent at being alone, and competence at something is not the same as wanting it. "Cal?" she said.
"Hmm?"
"The Northern Court, the legal counsel position." She turned the copper coin between her fingers, a habit she was apparently keeping. "I want to do the work. Actually do it, not just hold the title." "I know," he said, and there was no qualification in his voice. No, of course, within reason or as far as is appropriate. Just an acknowledgement of a true thing. The position has authority. Real authority. I wouldn't have it otherwise. She let herself breathe. The road north unfolded through forest and over stone bridges, and past small pack villages, where people stopped to watch the king's party pass, and nobody looked twice at the woman on the horse beside him, and that was fine. Being overlooked had never bothered her exactly. It was being dismissed that cut. There was a difference. She already knew, with the certainty she kept in the same place as her copper coin, that the court would notice her soon enough. She had things to say. Epilogue. 1 year later. The thing about the Northern Court, Senna had written in her notes on the first day, is that it was designed to make a certain kind of person feel large and everyone else feel small. She had spent the year systematically making it inconvenient to feel small. The legal ruling she'd drafted, 37 pages, meticulously sourced, on wage parity and educational access for wolfless citizens across Northern Alliance Pact territories, had passed the Council of Seats on a cold morning in early spring with a majority that surprised even the optimists. She had stood at the front of the chamber and read the summary aloud, and the chamber had been very quiet, and then very loud. Afterward, Cal had found her in the corridor. He was still the Northern King. He was also, in the year since the road from Vithara, the person she'd had more real conversations with than she'd had in the entire previous decade combined. He had learned the sound of her thinking silence, the difference between the quiet that meant she was working through something and the quiet that meant she had already decided. She had learned that he laughed more than kings were supposed to, and that he slept badly, and that he carried a weight he'd been carrying so long he'd forgotten it had a shape. In the spring, she had helped him name the shape. In the summer, he had asked her something on a stone balcony overlooking the northern mountains, with his signet ring in his hand, not on his finger. She had said yes. She had also said, very firmly, that the ring was his, and she already had her lucky object, thank you. He had laughed. He had put the ring back on his finger. Then he had taken her hand, and she had taken his, and they had stood there while the mountains went blue in the long evening light. Now it was winter. The corridors of the Vorith court smelled of pine smoke and cold stone, and Senna Morrow, soon to be Senna Vorith, in a ceremony 4 days off, stood at her study window with her copper coin in her palm. She had worn the copper smooth over the years. Her mother's hand had worn one side. Her own had done the other. It sat in her palm like a small warm thing that had been waiting. A life spent in hiding is already half a death. She had spent most of her life being told, in various ways, that small people should stay small, that wolfless was the same as worthless, that the measure of a life was the power it was born with. She had believed it, in the way you believe things when you are surrounded by them. She had been half dead with hiding before she knew it. The night she had crouched by a cage and asked a wolf if she could help him, she had stopped hiding. Not because it was safe to, it wasn't, and not because she'd had a plan, she hadn't. But because looking into those amber eyes and doing nothing would have been a small death, and she had run out of tolerance for small deaths. The coin caught the winter light. It was just copper, just luck, just her mother's hand and her own, and 20 years of being turned over by frightened fingers. But it was real, and it was hers, and it had been in her pocket on the night she'd stood on an execution platform and refused to look away. And that was the night everything changed. Behind her, the study door opened. She knew his footstep by now. She knew it the way you know weather, the way you know the light in a place you have decided to stay. "They're asking if you want to review the ceremony arrangements," Cal said. "Apparently there are 17 opinions about the processional, and I have refused all of them, so the steward has come to you." She turned. He was leaning in the doorway in his informal clothes, which he wore with considerably more ease than he wore the formal ones, and his expression had the particular quality it got when he was pretending to be beleaguered, but was actually content. "Tell them I'll review tomorrow," she said. "Tonight I'm busy." He looked at the coin in her hand. "Your mother's?" He crossed the room and stood beside her at the window. Below, the Vorith Court's winter gardens lay under snow, every path and planted border blanketed in white, quiet and clean and waiting. He did not reach for the coin or ask to hold it. He had learned early that there were things she kept for herself, and that this was not distance, but dimension. He stood close enough that she could feel the warmth of him, and they looked out at the snow together. 4 days, he said. 4 days, she agreed. She closed her fingers around the copper coin. For luck, her mother had said. And luck had become something she understood differently now. Not fortune, not fate, but the accumulated weight of chosen moments. The cost of stepping into full sight and refusing to step back. The prize of being seen by someone who was actually looking. She had given the coin to a wolf in a cage, as a parting gift. The wolf had still been holding it when he shifted to run. He had given it back to her on the road north, pressed into her palm while she slept against his shoulder, without explanation and without condition. She had never asked how he'd held on to it in the shift. She suspected she already knew. Some things are carried in the body's deepest memory, in the part that knows what matters before the mind has caught up. She put the coin back in her pocket. "Come on," she said. "I'll tell the steward myself." Cal smiled, that unkingly smile she'd been collecting all year like stones from a riverbed, and offered her his arm, and they walked together into the warm and complex brightness of a life that was, at last, entirely unlocked. She was not hiding. She was not half a death. She was, in the fullest possible sense, here. End.